This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Welcome to Aaron Mankey's Cabinet of Curiosities, a production of iHeartRadio and Grim and Mild.
Our world is full of the unexplainable. And if history is an open book, all of these amazing tales are right there on display, just waiting for us to explore. Welcome to the Cabinet of Curiosities. When the world makes one weary, it's not uncommon for that person to imagine something better. A world where there is no war, or famine, or homelessness, where people take care of one another and live in harmony. It's a lovely sentiment, but while it may work in theory, it almost always falls apart in practice. Communes and organizations led by one person, often a man, end up the same way. They turn into cults. That wasn't the goal for religious philosopher and preacher John Humphrey Noyes, but even his idealistic troop wound up with that notorious label. However, unlike other cults, his didn't end with a mass death or suicide. It ended with spooning. John was born in 1811 in Brattleboro, Vermont. His father had been a teacher, a minister, and had even served with the U.S. House of Representatives, while his mother happened to be the aunt of the 19th U.S. President, Rutherford B. Hayes. John was religious, like his father, but even more so, after witnessing a revival in 1831, he went through a conversion and abandoned his law degree at Dartmouth in favor of the seminary instead. He studied the Bible, well, religiously, and learned how to preach before diving into the world of anti-slavery activism. However, the more he studied, the more obsessive he grew. His beliefs shifted. For example, while enrolled at the Yale Theological Seminary, John had tried to pin down the date of Christ's second coming, which to many was meant to be a date set far into the future. But not to John. He believed that it had already happened in 70 AD, and that humans were on a downward spiral towards sin and degradation. He preached perfectionism, that those who had converted could be free of all sin. He also believed in keeping multiple wives, known as complex marriage. His views got him expelled from Yale, with his professors labeling him as a heretic. But that didn't deter him from exploring them further. He believed that his faith had given him carte blanche to ignore the traditional moral values of the time, and that he could do as he pleased. His family encouraged him to return home and find a new path, but John refused. He instead traveled around, preaching to anyone who would listen and picking up strays, in a way. One of those strays happened to be a woman named Abigail Merwin, who was already married when she started following John's teachings. John, however, developed feelings for his student and wouldn't let a trivial thing such as marriage get in his way. In 1837, he created the idea of a spiritual spouse, which flew in the face of traditional monogamy. To John, relationships were meant to be shared, and the more wives a man had, the merrier. In fact, the term free love, which picked up steam during the late 1960s, was originally coined by John. As he continued to preach, he gained more followers, leading to the creation of the Society of Inquiry around 1845. With almost 36 members under its wing, the Society became the start of John's grand utopian vision. Unfortunately, John's unorthodox beliefs, especially those concerning his nine wives, were not shared by the Vermont legislature. The spiritual leader was arrested and charged with adultery. However, he was released before the start of his trial in April and used that time to organize his followers and leave Vermont entirely. So they moved to New York, where they settled in a small city in the middle of the state. John happened to know some of the fellow perfectionists there who were able to share a portion of their land and help his people get established. He even renamed the group after their new home. What had started as a modest commune eventually grew into a palatial state that they called the Mansion House, completed in 1862. And how did they get the money to build such a house? Well, they sold all manner of goods, such as canned fruits and vegetables, thread, leather bags, and hats. But it was the production and sale of something even more desirable that put their commune on the map. And even after their community fell apart in the early 1880s, that business continued to thrive. Look in most kitchens today, and you're likely to find something from the company, some product of the lucrative business they began almost 200 years ago. Forks, knives, and spoons, all made and sold by a utopian community at the New York town of Oneida.
In the 1980s and 90s, New York City needed a tough cop like Detective Louis Scarsella.
Putting bad guys away, there's no feeling like it in the world.
He was the guy who made sure the worst killers were brought to justice.
That's one version.
This guy is a piece of shit.
Derek Hamilton was put away for murder by Detective Scarsella.
In prison, Derek turned himself into the best jailhouse lawyer of his generation.
And the law was my girlfriend. This is my only way to freedom.
Derek and other convicted murderers
started a law firm behind bars.
We never knew we had the same cop in the case.
Scarsella.
We gotta show that he's a corrupt cop.
They can go f*** themselves.
I'm Steve Fishman.
And I'm Dax Devlin Ross. And this is The Burden.
Listen to new episodes of The Burden on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. And to hear episodes 1 week early and ad-free with exclusive bonus content, subscribe to True Crime Clubhouse on Apple Podcasts.
Read any book, watch any movie or TV show, or see any play, and you probably don't realize that they all have one thing in common: William Shakespeare. Even though the playwright behind Othello, Hamlet, and King Lear may not have written the works being produced today, his tropes and his words are all over them. Stories about deceitful family members, star-crossed lovers, and enemies who become lovers can all chart their origins back to Shakespeare. So can words like lonely, swagger, and zany. Shakespeare was responsible for more than 1,700 words in the English language that we still use today. But he was far from the only writer of his time. Many had come before him and had also contributed significantly to the written word. However, one stands above them all. Before Romeo and Juliet, before Plato and Aristotle, there was Enna Duwana. Enna Duwana was the daughter of Sargon of Akkad, founder of the Akkadian Empire in ancient Mesopotamia. She lived during the 23rd century BC, but almost nothing was known about her until 1927. That year, a British archaeologist named Sir Leonard Woolley found several ancient relics in his travels that carried her name. One was a disc made of alabaster that had broken apart into several pieces. The artifact was eventually reconstructed, which allowed scholars to read its contents. The back of the disc mentioned Sargon of Akkad, Enna Duwana, and her husband, Nena Suin. Sargon had been a ruthless conqueror who had laid waste to dozens of cities and city-states across the region with his massive army. One of those city-states was a place called Ur, located in present-day Iraq. Ur had been home to a Sumerian cult built around Nena Suin. Sargon knew the importance of bridging the gaps between the Akkadian and Sumerian empires, and Nena Suin was at the center of each, so he appointed Enna Duwana to the role of high priestess to handle the job. But Nena Suin wasn't a human like Enna Duwana, or even Sargon. He was a god, specifically the moon god, and Enna Duwana worshipped him. As high priestess, she came to embody Nena Suin's actual wife, the goddess Ningal, hence her being listed on the disc as the moon god's spouse. The other side of the disc bore a relief of Enna Duwana, standing before a nude figure pouring some kind of drink. It was possible that the figure was Nena Suin. Soon after, other objects were excavated and reassembled, shedding more light on the identity of the elusive daughter of Sargon the Great. Enna Duwana's Sumerian name translated to Ornament of Heaven, and she had a great political sway among her people. Her parentage and her high-ranking status made her a leader, and with the help of her writings, she was able to unify Mesopotamia. Poems, religious hymns, and other works that had been lost for thousands of years were now being dug up and analyzed. They gave deeper insight into a woman who didn't know her true place in history. Enna Duwana was the world's first named author. She composed odes to the Sumerian goddess Inanna and the Akkadian goddess Ishtar, odes that exalted the deities of both cultures and brought them together. Her work was instrumental in building one central belief system for the people of Mesopotamia. She did this through her poems, which she wrote for 42 southern temples, expounding on the individual qualities that she admired in each of them, all of which had been chiseled into clay tablets. Many of the tablets recovered by Woolley and other archaeologists were only fragments, with large chunks of her writing broken off and missing. But what was there was still enlightening. In a hymn titled The Exaltation of Inanna, Anna Duwana wrote of the goddess's penchant for violence. The author prayed to her for help with a Sumerian rebel named Lugal-Anna, who had knocked her from her perch as high priestess. She begged for revenge against the rebel and to have her title restored. In the end, her prayers were answered, and Anna Duwana was once again made high priestess to her people. Another hymn, which was told from the goddess Inanna's perspective, spoke of revenge against the mountains of Iba, because they would not bow down to her. After being turned down for help from the other gods, she destroyed the mountains herself. According to some experts, this hymn was Anna Duwana's way of telling a fictional story about a very real ecological disaster that had occurred. Anna Duwana was a person unlike any other. She didn't just pray to her gods, she wrote poetic narratives about them. They became like characters to her, with lives and wills of their own. Not many people know who Anna Duwana is today, and that's a shame, because there is still so much she can teach us. She wasn't just the first named author. She was among the very best who ever lived. I hope you've enjoyed today's guided tour of the Cabinet of Curiosities. Subscribe for free on Apple Podcasts or learn more about the show by visiting curiositiespodcast.com. This show was created by me, Aaron Mankey, in partnership with How Stuff Works. I make another award-winning show called Lore, which is a podcast, book series, and television show. And you can learn all about it over at theworldoflore.com. And until next time, stay curious. Thank you.